Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to today's podcast. What do you feel when, at sporting events or other public gatherings, crowds join in a call to support the troops? If you're like me, I always have some misgivings. On the simplest level, the gesture seems pretty meaningless. What am I or anyone else in that crowd actually doing to support the troops? And when they add some cliched phrases about fighting for our freedoms, a voice in my head always asks, yeah, how? Where? In Iraq? Afghanistan? Operating a drone that's flying over Pakistan or Yemen? Today's guest, Andrew Bacevich, has thought long and hard about such things and has written a series of fairly short, fairly very readable books that pursue questions that too many ignore or pretend don't matter. The United States has been at war for more than a decade. Yet as war has become normalized, a gap has widened between America's soldiers and the society in whose name they fight. For ordinary citizens, as former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates has acknowledged, armed conflict has become an abstraction. Military service, something other people do. In his latest book, Breach of Trust, Bacevich takes stock of the separation between Americans and their military, tracing its origins to the Vietnam era and exploring its implications, which include a nation with an appetite for war, waged at enormous expense by a volunteer army and a huge number of private contractors, unable to achieve victory. In a previous book, The Limits of Power, which I highly recommend, Bacevich pulled things together in ways I hadn't seen before, things like our politics of personality, the rise of the imperial presidency, and our national culture of consumption, and how all of those link to our military adventures. I advise people to pay attention to Andrew Bacevich, his combination of military experience, commitment to a deep examination of root causes, and his passionate articulation of both questions and answers, routinely ignored by far too many, make him a singular voice for sanity, idealism, and a wholly reconsidered view of American society and our role in the world. Here on Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, and the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, and provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, media, culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. Andrew Bacevich, professor of history and international relations at Boston University, served 23 years in the U.S. Army, retiring with the rank of colonel. He also lost his son in Iraq. A graduate of the U.S. Military Academy, he received his Ph.D. in American diplomatic history from Princeton. His writing has appeared in Foreign Affairs, The Atlantic Monthly, The Nation, The New York Times, The Los Angeles Times, and The Wall Street Journal. He's the author of several books, including The New American Militarism, Limits of Power, Washington Rules, and his latest, Breach of Trust, How Americans Failed Their Soldiers and Their Country. Welcome again, Andrew Bacevich, to Free Forum.
Oh, thank you very much.
I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work that we talk about. So let me ask you first, how was it that you joined the military?
Well, I was born right after World War II. Both my parents were World War II veterans. I grew up in the Midwest in a family that was Catholic, largely conservative in its orientation. I mean that more in terms of culture than politics. And patriotism was very much part of the environment in which I was raised, and military service was admired. And so when I was getting ready to go to college and examining the choices that were available to me, the military academy happened to be particularly attractive. And, you know, you take a first step and then suddenly you find yourself taking a second and a third and a fourth. And before you know it, you know, your life's half over.
Yeah. No, I do remember, actually, I graduated high school in 65, that very high in the ranking of universities that were considered were the military academies at that point. I don't know whether it's still the same.
That's still the case today. If you look at the U.S. news rankings and things mm-hmm. like that they still rate very highly.
Yeah, and we're actually speaking when the budget shutdown has canceled their football games this weekend. Your earlier book, Washington Rules, opens with a moment in your life. We talked about when you joined the military. This was a moment when it seems you took stock differently. You say this moment was a turning point. Could you share that experience?
Well, I was serving in Germany at the end of the Cold War, and right after unification, I took a trip with my family to Berlin, and which for somebody of my generation was the geographic center of international politics because of its symbolic significance in the Cold War, and so I wanted to see Berlin for myself. Took my family, and I cajoled my wife on a rather cold and rainy night to walk along the Unter den Linden, this avenue, approaching the Brandenburg Gate from the Old East. So I was walking through what just weeks before had been East Germany, got up to the Brandenburg Gate, and again, this is sort of late at night on a kind of a nasty night, and what I found there were a bunch of young men that were peddling bits and pieces of Red Army paraphernalia, and it quickly became evident that they were off-duty Russian soldiers who were selling this stuff for money, and it was all junk. I mean, I was just surprised by the cheapness of what even the Soviet military produced. And that was the first inkling, or one of the first inklings that I had, that to some considerable degree we had oversold ourselves on the threat posed by the Soviet Union and the Soviet Empire.
Very good. Now, at that same point, Andrew Bacevich, that is the end of the Cold War, in the new book, Breach of Trust, you talk about what happens sort of in the corridors of power. On the one hand, I remember great talk of a peace dividend, now that we didn't have to contain the Soviet Union. On the other, there arose a view that the world was actually going to be more dangerous, not less. Could you talk about that moment?
Well, in the wake of not simply in the wake of the Cold War, but also in the immediate wake of Operation Desert Storm, our first encounter, military encounter with Saddam Hussein, the national security apparatus to some degree found itself looking for a job, looking for a rationale for its continued existence and for its continuing claim on resources, budget. And what I discovered when I reviewed the arguments made by American Army generals at that time, we're talking now sort of between 1991 and 1995 or 1996, what I discovered was that the military leadership had quickly pivoted away from the notion that the military's chief mission was to deter and defend and contain adversaries, and instead had embraced the idea that the military's chief mission should be to project power, to intervene, to go out there and fix problems. And although, of course, this was to some degree motivated by bureaucratic politics, trying to demonstrate continued relevance, it also reflected the military's own reading of Operation Desert Storm, that this appeared to be to provide evidence of the United States having achieved the point of insurmountable military primacy. So the generals fancied that we couldn't be beat, or perhaps more explicitly, they fancied that any time the U.S. went to war, it was going to win quickly, decisively, and economically. And of course, when that proposition was put to the test after 9/11, it quickly became apparent that it simply was not true. And we found ourselves bogged down in long, protracted wars that we couldn't end at all.
This is Free Forum. I'm Terrence McNally, and I'm speaking with Andrew Bacevich, U.S. Army colonel retired after 23 years, professor of international relations and history at Boston University, and author of The Limits of Power. We're talking about his newest book, Breach of Trust, how Americans failed their soldiers and their country. So, yeah, you point out that Desert Storm, while an anomaly in the post-Cold War era, was held by these leaders as the perfect example. Besides being, you know, not blinded, but let's say influenced by their own wants for continuing the budget, continuing careers, and so on, how do you think that was missed as much as it was?
Well, I mean, on behalf of that generation of military leaders, I would also have to add the notion that this was the generation that had fought the Vietnam War and had experienced the humiliation of failure, had experienced the sense of abandonment on the part of the American people that pervaded the officer corps in the wake of Vietnam. So Desert Storm, again, a partial victory at best, particularly in the political or strategic context, but Desert Storm was a moment of redemption for this generation of officers. And therefore, the tendency to see Desert Storm as something other than a one-off event was very strong.
Yeah.
And the generals came away from Desert Storm saying, this is the way war is supposed to be fought. And this is the kind of war that we will inevitably win. And so the image of high-tech conventional warfare ending in a decisive victory became pervasive. And therefore was a source of confidence that wherever we go, whoever we face, victory is going to be an inevitable consequence. It turned out to be not the case.
Right. I mean, it's so interesting. You talk also about their philosophy of that we're going to do more with less, and that high tech was going to take the dominance that we had for most of.
Well, yeah. I mean, in retrospect, it seems profoundly, almost silly. You know, shallow. How could professionals have allowed themselves to be deluded this way? But on the other hand, remember that they are thinking about the future of warfare at a time when American society in general is infatuated with the notion of how information technology was going to transform our lives in such profound ways. The generals believed that information technology was going to change warfare in profound ways, and they were persuaded that the United States military had a permanent edge on adversaries when it came to using information. Again, in retrospect, it becomes apparent that kind of thinking was based on just a series of fallacious assumptions.
Yeah, the part that strikes me is that where does intelligence overlap with this? In other words, to look at fighting a standing army of Saddam Hussein's versus what, of course, has happened since then, which is fighting insurgencies more like Vietnam wars than Desert Storm.
I think the charge against them is that they were ahistorical.
Yeah.
That they assumed that technology rendered history irrelevant. Because to take the history of warfare seriously is to appreciate the pervasiveness of chance, to appreciate how frequently unintended consequences ensue, how nations go to war with one another and are constantly caught by surprise by the actual developments that war produces. That generation of American officers simply chose, I think, to forget the history of warfare, and therefore they were not alert to the warnings that history provided.
Mm-hmm. I'm talking with Andrew Bacevich about the ideas in his new book, Breach of Trust. You point out some things, as I mentioned in the introduction, that a lot of people ignore. For example, as you just mentioned, the fact that we don't win wars anymore. Talk a bit about a couple of things. One, why don't we? Okay. But the other is, I was thinking about this as I was preparing for this interview, why the American people, American leadership, the American culture doesn't recognize that fact more and why it doesn't trouble us more.
Well, that's the central theme of the book, I think, or at least the central question that the book tries to take up. And my answer, simply put, is that the creation of the professional military, the one we commonly called the all-volunteer force after Vietnam, reflected a decision, an ill-advised decision in my view, to jettison the tradition of the citizen soldier. And most of us have now forgotten that the citizen soldier formed the cornerstone of the American military system, going back to the Revolutionary War all the way up to the Vietnam War. Well, the catastrophe of Vietnam led Americans to say, we don't want that tradition anymore. Nixon validated that decision by ending the draft and creating the all-volunteer force. And what occurred then in ensuing decades was a gap emerged between the American military and American society. And I argue that, in effect, the American people forfeited any ownership of what had been their military. What had been an American army became Washington's army. And after 9/11, this exceedingly hubristic, arrogant, foolish administration of George W. Bush decided they were going to take this army, which they assumed could not be beaten, and they were going to embark upon a project to transform the greater Middle East. That project basically failed in Iraq, and we ended up with a war that the professional army could not win, with political leaders no longer having the alternative of going to the people to raise up a bigger army that might, I don't know if it would have, but might have been able to manage the situation. And in the meantime, the American people, dishonestly claiming to support the troops, sat on the sidelines and watched as all this happened.
Yeah, I mean, I get all that, and I really do see this disconnect as making it easier for that to happen. It's still, in the back of my mind, I go, Americans are so enamored with our exceptionalism and so enamored with winning and you know, USA, USA, that the fact that we can't win and we don't win I'm surprised that it hasn't infected the national culture more.
But I certainly would argue that we have not won, and I think you agree with that.
Yeah.
But if you consider the way that the military itself and Washington have portrayed the post 9/11 wars, they are selling a different interpretation. The interpretation, let's talk specifically about Iraq.
Yeah.
The interpretation that Washington sells is, oh yes, the war went badly for a while, but then Bush discovered a genius general named David Petraeus.
Right. This is the story.
David Petraeus devised a genius approach to war called counterinsurgency, and together they implemented something called the surge, and that in effect won the war. I mean, there are still plenty of commentary in the press that would have the American people believe that David Petraeus won the war in Iraq. Now, in truth, that proposition is utterly unsustainable. And all you need to do is to pick up a daily newspaper and read about the latest set of bombings in Iraq, killing dozens of people. That's happening on a daily basis, to realize that we didn't end the Iraq War. We opted out of the Iraq War, and the Iraq War continues down. The Iraq War that we started continues down to the present day.
Yeah, and you have some wonderful quotes in there, Andrew Bacevich, of Obama saying, you know, how the words are carefully chosen. We have successfully withdrawn, or we have successfully completed operations,
right.
those sorts of things.
The Obama administration, in a sense, did a favor for the George W. Bush administration by, putting a smiley face on the conclusion of the Iraq War, which was, in effect, an orderly withdrawal on the part of the United States short of achieving our policy goals.
Right. In other words, you dropped the bar low enough and we successfully disengaged. Well, that's success. I'm Terrence McNally. This is Free Forum, and I'm speaking with Andrew Bacevich, U.S. Army colonel, retired after 23 years, professor of international relations and history at Boston University, author of a number of books. The Limits of Power is a particular favorite of mine. We're talking about his newest, Breach of Trust, How Americans Fail Their Soldiers and Their Country. Another thing that we're going to go into more of the things that we've touched on, but one other thing that I don't want to get through the hour without mentioning is another thing I have not seen a lot written or spoken about elsewhere. As a matter of fact, this is the first time I'd ever come across it, was what you talk about as the Israelization of our military vision and our military approach and all of this. That, to me, is a very fascinating subject. Could you talk about that?
Well, it seems to me that it is a fact that over the course of the past decade, increasingly, we have embraced methods pioneered by the State of Israel. Now, the State of Israel does what it does for what seem to be good reasons in the eyes of the Israeli government. I would argue that their methods, even if useful, applicable, moral, for their purposes, are not for us. And so to me, it's a puzzle. And I refer here, of course, to things like preventive war,
right,
which prior to 9/11, American presidents unanimously rejected as immoral and imprudent. I mean, it was one of the charges against the defendants at the Nuremberg trial was that they had engaged in preventive war. Well, the Israelis have done the same, and after 9/11, that's now our policy. Targeted assassination, which prior to 9/11 was prescribed by executive order, since 9/11, we've embraced it, and of course the Israelis have long embraced targeted assassination. The Israelis insist that the prerequisite for peace is, in effect, that their adversaries must disarm and effectively concede that Israel will continue to remain a dominant power. So you must be weak, I must be very strong. That's the recipe for peace. And in effect, that's become now the American expectation. You know, one sees it, for example, in the controversy over the putative Iranian nuclear program, that nobody is proposing that we're going to disarm.
Or Israel.
Or Israel, it's exactly right. But the other guy's got to give up his weapons, and then we'll talk about a peaceful relationship. So we lag behind the State of Israel in these matters, but there is this curious pattern whereby we have adopted methods that they pioneered.
Yeah, and as you point out, one can question whether they're moral or efficacious for anyone, but you point out that Israel is small, it's surrounded by putative enemies, and so on.
They've got a different set of circumstances.
Our circumstances are nothing like
those. We don't have their set of circumstances.
Yeah. Now, as I say, I was struck by your analysis. It made very good sense. Again, sort of, as you looked into this, how did this happen? Did one thing the Bush administration decides preemptive war is okay because of 9/11, and then other things follow? What seems to be going on behind the scenes?
Yeah, and I don't think I'm able to connect the dots as clearly as I'd like to be able to do. But I do think that within certain quarters of the national security elite, there was this admiration of Israel's approach and a desire to have the United States become more like Israel in terms of a greater willingness to use force, a greater willingness to be proactive, and that 9/11, in a sense, created the opportunity for people of that ilk to advance their case.
Yeah, and there was the list you could go to at that point of Israel seeming to do what we claimed we were going to do, which is win short, efficient economic wars. It turns out that hasn't worked so well for Israel lately either.
Well, I mean, you're right. I mean, in a sense, if we had been reading the lessons of Israel's wars, they themselves, I think, would offer a warning that we would have done well to heed. I mean, the 1967 war, in a tactical, operational sense, stands as one of the most decisive conflicts in the 20th century. But strategically and politically, it was a disaster. I mean, I would argue it turned out to be a disaster for Israel, which began to assume that the Israeli army couldn't be beaten. That sense of military power produced political ambitions to create a greater Israel. And here we are, several decades later, and Israel is, in many respects, to my mind, not that I'm Israeli and it's not my business, but they're stuck with these territories. Mm. And as a consequence, they're increasingly stuck with a set of circumstances that don't bode well for the future of the Jewish state.
Yeah, whether it's demographics or whatever else, you're right. They reached out, expanded, and then had to deal with that. In some sense, it's the same way you point out that Desert Storm, which we claimed as a quick, decisive victory, was actually just the start of a war that still goes on for Iraqis.
Or more broadly, a war for the greater Middle East,
yeah.
with Iraq having been only one front.
Right. And I am going to read one quote of yours just before we leave this Israeli comparison. You say that as early as 1945, among several great powers, faith in war's problem-solving capacity disappeared altogether. Among nations classified as liberal democracies, only two resisted this trend. One was the United States. The other was Israel, back as far as 1945.
Well, I mean, I'm referring here to the European powers,
right?
To the countries that we used to think were powers, Great Britain, France, Germany in its post 1945 democratic form. I mean, the people and I think the political elites in those countries look back on the two world wars as an unspeakable catastrophe that had not only killed millions of people and consumed unbelievable amounts of treasure, but had in effect led to the squandering of European power, led to the decline of European states that had been politically dominant in international relations.
For centuries.
And so what they learned from the wars of 1914, 1918, and 1939, 1945 was that, except as a last resort, war is a bad idea. We came out of the war strengthened by the events of World War II, and therefore we took different lessons. Israel also took different lessons from its early military experience.
Yeah, let me also ask you right now, one of the things that was also new to me in Breach of Trust, and I just want you to talk about it briefly because it fits right here, is that the actual way that FDR waged World War II, in other words, although we lost many, it was nothing compared to what the Russians lost, what others lost, that there was a calculation in the strategy and the way we fought World War II, which to some extent may have led to some of that triumphalism. Could you talk just a bit about that?
It's more than strategy, is what I'm trying to argue. What I'm trying to argue is that FDR forged an implicit compact between the government and the American people about how that war would be fought. On the one hand, Roosevelt was clear that the war would entail sacrifice of all of us. We would fight with a large army, and there were going to be severe losses. Taxes would go up. Consumption would be curtailed. So he engaged the American people in that war. On the other hand, the terms of the engagement were such that he was not going to recklessly squander American lives, that he was going to outsource the actual fighting of the war to some considerable extent to our allies, most notably the Soviets, that he was going to emphasize our role as an arsenal of democracy, as he called it. And because of our relative separation from the main areas of of a conflict, what that meant was this: let the other guy fight while we produce the materiel.
Right, right.
What that meant was that, in essence, prosperity was restored to the United States after a decade of depression. So we came out of the war better off. The American people supported the war, and the American people benefited from the war. And I contrast that with the post 9/11 wars, in which, despite some rhetoric on the part of George Bush, in which he said that we were called upon to engage in this great struggle, the fact of the matter is he marginalized the American people. We were not engaged with the war, not engaged with our military. And I think that's one of the reasons why the outcome of the post 9/11 wars differs so much from the outcomes of World War II. World War II made us richer and stronger. The post 9/11 wars have made us weaker, and we have squandered our wealth to no real end.
This is Free Forum. I'm Terrence McNally speaking with Andrew Bacevich, U.S. Army colonel, retired after 23 years, professor of international relations and history at Boston University, author of a number of books. We're talking about his newest, Breach of Trust, How Americans Failed Their Soldiers and Their Country. Let's go back to that question point at which Nixon and the military shift from a citizen army to a volunteer army. One thing you point out, I think, which is worth noting, is that when he ended the draft, it sort of substituted for ending the war, right? In other words, he runs sort of saying he will end the war, but all he does is end the draft. The war goes on for years, as we know, and the Cambodian bombings and all of these things. But for him, it was a political calculation. But for the military, it was a different kind of calculation. Talk just a little bit about that, and then, as you point out throughout the book, the ill effects of this shift.
Well, I mean, there's no question that the impact of the Vietnam War on the military generally, and above all on my service, the Army, was quite drastic, was terrible in terms of the erosion of good order and discipline, of morale, of the pervasive problems related to racial tensions, to drug use, and the like. It was a bad time for the American military, and to some degree, the military leadership at the time viewed the draft as the definition, as the essence of their problem. In other words, to restore good order and discipline, to purge the ranks of these pathologies, it seemed expedient to allow soldiers who didn't want to serve to be gone, to fill the ranks with people who would be volunteers. And again, in the context of the time, it's not that this is, you know, irrational, foolish. It was trying to respond to near-term problems that were very, very serious. Very few senior leaders at the time, some, but very few appreciated the implications of disengaging the military from the American people. So, you know, I'm not entirely unsympathetic with the decisions that were made at the time, but regardless of the fact, we have to deal with the consequences that have ensued, and the consequences are more negative than positive.
Right, and the one that seems that most runs through this book is the disengagement of the American people. As I mentioned at the top, the "we support our troops, but we may not know any," that sort of thing. What are some other negatives? Oh, and I will say, the other, which I would like you to talk about, is the rise of independent privatized military contractors.
Well, so here we have a relatively small army in which Washington has invested enormous confidence. And Washington sends the army to Afghanistan and Iraq where it doesn't win. Now, as I suggested earlier, in the era of the tradition of the citizen soldier, if the war were worth fighting, the president could have turned to the people and said, "Well, I need to raise up a big citizen army in order to handle this task." If let's recall the Civil War, where people thought the Civil War, both sides, thought the Civil War would be won in a single battle. And when that turned out not to be the case, President Lincoln understood that he needed to raise up a mighty legion to undertake what turned out to be a very long and brutal war. George W. Bush didn't have that option, even if he had wanted to, because the people had disengaged. So what do you do when you have too much war and too few warriors, especially when your allies won't step up to the plate? Well, what George W. Bush did was to open the doors to a vastly larger role to be played by private contractors. So institutions that saw war as an opportunity to make money were invited into the war zone in very large numbers. War has always been, for some people, a way to make money. War after 9/11 became almost primarily a means to make money. And among other things, this opened up the door to vast corruption, and it turned out that these private contractors weren't very good at getting the job done.
And you point out also that we, in some sense, broke our word with the National Guard, that the National Guard had always been a force that would be called on only as a last resort. In Iraq and Afghanistan, they became just another part of the military.
Right. I mean, the National Guard is the remnant of the citizen soldier tradition. But the expectation of guardsmen is that they would only serve in true national emergencies, with World War II being an example of that, or even Korea being an example of that. But what's happened in more recent years is that the Guard and the reserves have in effect become an adjunct of the regular military.
I mean, it's been done in other books. It's been done on this program before. But a few highlights or lowlights, if you will, of the corruption and the failures of contractors.
I mean, I don't know that I can, if you want specific cases, but I mean, I think the short story is that decision makers in Washington want to mobilize contractor support quickly. One consequence of that is that they provide the majority of contracting opportunities to a small number of firms with whom they are familiar, and many of which happen to be run by ex-military people. So there's a favoritism involved in that regard. Because contracts are let very quickly, oversight tends to be exceedingly loose. Accountability tends to be all but non-existent, and so the interests of the taxpayer are not protected. But there, too, because of the way the people have disengaged from war, there's remarkably little demand for accountability coming from the voters. President Bush consciously, I think, decided that there would be no need for us to pay for the wars that he initiated. And so we paid for the wars by going ever greater into debt with a disengaged population finding nothing objectionable about that.
Right. And one of the other things you point out about contractors is that they become redundant with a conscripted army, that a return to the draft, a return to a citizen army, and the contractor's gig is pretty much up.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if indeed we had the capacity, the government had the capacity to create a greater army when the need for a greater army existed, then there would be no requirement to have these massive quantities of contractors flooding the war zone.
And one other thing that you mentioned is that it's a jobs program that pays better than the military, but that most of those jobs are foreign nationals.
Well, that's correct. I mean, when a big firm like KBR gets a contract for transporting goods or for establishing base camps or for preparing food, the supervisory personnel, the executives, are going to be well-paid Americans, but a lot of people that are actually doing the work are going to be minimum-wage employees recruited from third world countries like Bangladesh. So it's a jobs program of a sort, but even the jobs don't necessarily go to Americans.
Yeah, that's the voice of Andrew Bacevich. We're talking about some of the ideas in his newest book, Breach of Trust, how Americans fail their soldiers in their country. I'm Terrence McNally. This is Free Forum. Now, another thing that you point out about the volunteer army is that it is not representative of the wider population. I've spoken to someone fairly high up in the military, and this is he will remain anonymous, but he says that the military is not just randomly unrepresentative, but that it is becoming increasingly Christian and, to perhaps a lesser extent, rural and southern. Any thoughts about that? And you talk about Boykinism and Boykin, but he's talking about that what he sees, in the academies and in the service is a move toward that sort of lack of representation.
Well, there are trends going back probably again to Vietnam, in which the military let's focus on the officer corps, in which the officer corps began to acquire a political coloration that had not been the case. I mean, the officer corps in which I was commissioned back in 1969 adhered to a tradition of being apolitical. I mean, you might vote Republican, you might vote Democratic, but to tell you the truth, it was not an important issue. One did not identify with one party or the other as a military professional. That began to change after Vietnam. And in particular, it changed once Ronald Reagan became president. And there was an interval of time of 20 years or so in which the officer corps viewed the Republican Party as their friends and the Democratic Party as their adversaries. So the military became more conservative in a political sense as well as a cultural sense. And became more partisan in the sense that it leaned Republican as opposed to Democratic. My speculation, and I can't prove this, is that as that occurred, military service became increasingly attractive to conservative Protestant evangelicals. Real believers in a fundamentalist form of Christianity, and a version of Christianity that was not simply evangelical in its title, but that saw itself as engaged in kind of a missionary enterprise. And so we've had a considerable number of scandals. Probably the most serious focused on the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs, which not so incidentally, Colorado Springs happens to be a hotbed of conservative Protestant evangelicalism.
Focus on the family.
There's been some amount of concerns of Christians in the officer corps trying to Christianize the military, which is inappropriate.
Mm-hmm. A big point you make is you say we are not victims of what we're talking about in this, that we, the people, if disconnected, if disengaged, that does not mean that they are blameless. And you also talk about the intellectuals and the media and their role in all of this. And you point out in with some specifics, but something which I seem to notice over and over again, which is this idea that for intellectuals or the media to be, quote, taken seriously, you must not question the Beltway worldview. And this happens in all sorts of issues, but this is really true about the military as well.
Well, I think that's exactly it. And the Beltway view is that, the use of military power is the ultimate expression of American leadership. And that problem here, I think, both among the people and among what I guess we call these days thought leaders, is that so few have any skin in the game. So few of us serve. So few of us have members of our family who are on the line, whether in places like Iraq or Afghanistan or wherever, that I think it hollows out the discussion of U.S. military policy. Everybody's proclaiming to support the troops, but the truth is there's remarkably little attention to where the troops are being sent, what they're being asked to do, and what price they pay as a consequence. And I find it, I don't think we should let the American people off the hook here.
Right.
That they're their claims of supporting the troops ring hollow, and the people should be called upon it. And the absence of serious consideration of military matters on the part of elites also is, frankly, contemptible.
Yeah, and that goes back to that thing I said before. We talked about it a bit, but it still rings in the back of my head. Why we tolerate and completely, it seems to me, gloss over not only the lack maybe of justification of what we're doing, but the lack of success. And that, of course, the government shutdown happens. One of the last things they do is they pass a bill to make sure that the military checks will continue to flow.
Right.
When there's a crisis domestically, we need to find a way to pay for it. When there's an ongoing war going nowhere in another country, the taxi meter just runs. And
right.
it just goes. And I myself can't understand it from our leadership, and I can't understand it from our people.
Well, I think, you know, there is this unwillingness to evaluate seriously what our wars have achieved and at what cost. I mean, you know, it is astonishing to me how quickly we have simply jettisoned the Iraq War from our memory bank. It has become a non-event rather than something that should have chastened us and should have caused us to reflect deeply both about our military system and about our approach to foreign policy. But it's almost irrelevant.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Foreign policy discussions.
We may not have drawn the correct conclusions or taken the right actions based on our response to the Vietnam War, but it mattered. The Iraq War, you know, less people die, but trillions will end up being spent. And as we know, the PTSD, the head injuries, the
right.
things that are going on will be with us for,
right.
I'm saying generations, let's say decades. And Joe Stiglitz and Linda Bilmes have the price tag at $3, $4, $5 trillion,
right.
and there's no reflection.
Well, there's no reflection because there's no bite to it. I mean, you can read their book, you can assess the data, but there's nobody reaching into my pocket right now saying, okay, that means your Social Security is going to be reduced in order to pay for the war. Were that to happen, then I can assure you that the American people would overnight come to appreciate the significance of a war that is going to ultimately cost us several trillions of dollars.
This is Free Forum. I'm Terrence McNally. That's Andrew Bacevich. We're talking about breach of trust, how Americans fail their soldiers in their country. You advocate a return to the draft and
not quite, and
national service.
I discuss the draft as a policy alternative. I don't really think that politically it's going to get much traction. I suggest that an alternative to that, an alternative that could both close the gap between the military and society and also give us a more representative military and also enrich our concept of citizenship, would be to enact a program of national service where every 18-year-old owes a term of service to country and community, some of them performing that service in the military.
I mean, it seems to me, it so harkens back to ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. And following on that, we have VISTA and we have the Peace Corps.
Yes.
And given how we have trouble with jobs and everything, it seems like that would be a proposal that would solve or speak to so many of our nation's needs.
Well, I agree. And I think what's needed is to get somebody in Washington to promote the conversation. I mean, I think it would be, President Obama's moral capital is probably close to having been spent, but if he were to create a presidential commission on national service, you know, one of these blue ribbon exercises to evaluate, to hold hearings, to produce a report, to weigh pros and cons, that might be a way to get the idea injected into politics. But it would take something like that to jumpstart the conversation on national service.
Yeah. Finally, this may be the last question. We've got about three more minutes. You cite the lack of a consistent strategy since we turned away from containment. And you talk about how things are, you know, this is based on hubris, this is based on bad judgment, but there's no consistent strategy. Can you imagine one for this country at this time?
Well, I think I could, but it would have to be, to come to a reasoned strategy, you need to have a realistic understanding of the world and the direction that events are headed, and you need to have a pragmatic appreciation for who we are and what we can achieve. One of the problems, I think, with coming to those realistic judgments is the overhang of the 20th century, in a sense, that we choose to remember the 20th century as a story of triumph that ends with the United States as the world's sole remaining superpower and the world yearning to be like us. Well, that was false back at the end of the Cold War, and it's certainly false today. We're moving into a multipolar world. Our ability to control events has been revealed as exceedingly limited, and so we need to become more modest in our understanding mm-hmm. of what we can do. Out of modesty could come a realistic strategy.
Okay, and finally, one thing, I'm going to ask something about the American character. We've been talking, focused very much on the military and so on, but one of the things that I've noticed is that whether it's Enron and the high-tech bubble and the corruption that was going on in corporate, or the Wall Street crash and the decisions made by companies and the financial industry, BP's Gulf oil disaster, even our response to climate change, I see us rooting so much in best-case scenario thinking, flawed
sure.
incentives, a lack of appreciation or respect
right.
for the risks we face and so on. It seems to me it goes across our culture. My final question would be your thoughts on that.
Well, I think you're right. I mean, the definition of freedom is somehow linked to expectations of more. And I think that's wrong. It's false. We need to connect our understanding of freedom and what it means to be a human being to something other than material consumption. And I'm afraid that most Americans have been so profoundly socialized to think in terms, to connect our expectations of happiness, to connect them to material consumption. It's going to be very difficult to wean us away from that and to get us to think more deeply about what it means to be a free human being.
Very good. The book, again, is Breach of Trust, How Americans Failed Their Soldiers and Their Country. Thank you, Andrew Bacevich. Keep up the good work. For this week's conversation and many other interviews, articles, transcripts of interviews, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly announcement by email of upcoming guests and issues telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and 3 or 4 or 5 articles of background, sign up at my site or email me at temcnally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to Freeform Podcast on iTunes. Thanks to G, my engineer, Stan Mizrahi in production, and to you, my listeners. I look forward to being with you again next week.